Good evening and welcome to the local news. Today is Monday, September 8th, and I'm Nat Cardos reporting for KMUD. In tonight's news, fire updates for the Dillon, Blue, and Log fires, McKinleyville sign expansion splits Humboldt Planning Commission, Save the Redwoods League and 49 others call for reallocation of funds from Prop 4 to save Sequoia old growth from wildfires. So stay tuned, those stories and more coming up.
Redwood Community Radio acknowledges that its transmitter sites are located on the unceded territory of the Tsingkiyon, Wailaki, Wiyot, Wilcut, and Kato people. We honor ancestors past, present, and emerging, and acknowledge the ongoing cultural, spiritual, and physical connection these tribes have to this region.
Fire updates on the Blue Fire, Log Fire, and Dillon Fire for September 8th. The Blue Fire is currently 3,543 acres and is 13% contained. There are currently 702 personnel on scene. Fire conditions continue to ease with overcast skies and rain that is expected for today and Tuesday. Rain is expected to slow the fire's spread, but larger fuels continue to burn and the fire could strengthen when the weather becomes warmer later this week. KMUD News spoke with Jason Engel, Public Information Officer for the Blue, Log, and Dillon fires, for more information.
And it's kind of the other side of the fire, the north end of the fire, where they're focusing a lot of effort there because they keep it out of the community of Syed. So they've got a line starting to establish also along the eastern edge of that fire along the Walker Creek Road. And that line is looking really good. And then they're starting to hook around to the north. And it's good lines along that northern edge of the fire as well. And like I said, with the fire, with the weather coming, it should help a lot.
The Pacific Crest Trail is close between the junction of the Kelsey National Recreation Trail and Sayad Valley. Southbound long-distance hikers are advised not to continue south of Mount Ashland in Oregon. For more information about closures on the Pacific Crest Trail, the website is closures.pcta.org. There are currently evacuation orders and warnings in place for the Blue Fire, which can be found at protect.genesys.com. That's protect.genasys.com. And now the Log Fire, which is currently at 1,156 acres and 0% containment. There are currently 44 personnel on scene. Engel explains more about fire operations on the Log Fire.
In the Log Fire, the fire has been backing very rugged terrain, so they haven't been able to put crews directly on the fire, but it hasn't had a lot of active fire activity. It's mostly back in most places, so it isn't really running and putting up a lot of heat and putting up a lot of growth. It is currently at, the Log Fire is currently at 1,156 acres, and it's 0% containment. The main thing with the Log Fire, because of the access, they're focusing on just structures, and they have some historic structures they've been prepping and trying to protect in and around in case the fire, they're a long ways from the fire, but in case the fire did become more active, they want to be out ahead of it and to have some structures, some historical structures that are on National Forest, make sure those structures are protected, smoke cabins and things like that.
Firefighters are currently working to clear the Woolly Creek Trail, which is the only ground access to the historic Woolly Creek cabins that were built in the early 20th century. Reportedly, President Herbert Hoover used to holiday in one of these cabins during his presidency. And now the Dillon Fire, which is currently 11,957 acres and at 57% containment, with 1,242 personnel on scene. The combination of rain and smoke in the area will lower visibility on the roads near the fire, and the public is encouraged to exercise caution and be mindful of heavy equipment when driving. Engel gives more information on the Dillon Fire.
Currently, it stands at 11,957 acres, and we're at 57% containment. And that's an increase of almost double what we had yesterday. That's a tribute to a lot of the work that's been going into putting the firefighters put into establishing lines around the perimeter of the fire. The biggest area where they've been focusing has been in the southern portion of the Dillon Fire, along a drainage, Rock Creek drainage, and that's where you've seen some containment actually increase in that area. And the reason to focus in that area is because of the community leans to the south of the fire, and they want to be sure to try to make sure that fire is being held at these areas along these lines as they can, and to keep the fire from moving further south. Now, it's still a long ways from Orleans, but that's the primary goal, though, is to keep the fire from moving south. And so they put a lot of effort into those lines on the southern end. And so far, it's held. It's doing really good. And with this weather coming in, that should help a lot, too, in trying to put the fire, but it won't necessarily put it out, but it'll definitely reduce the fire activity and give the firefighters a chance to get more lines established.
There are currently evacuation warnings and orders in place for the fire, which can be found at protect.genesys.com. Shelter information and evacuation resources are available through the Siskiyou County Office of Emergency Services at 530-340-3539. Intermittent closures of Highway 96 are possible, and road updates can be found on the Caltrans website, dot.ca.gov/travel. A virtual public meeting will be held at 6 p.m. today, September 8th, and can be accessed through the Six Rivers and Klamath National Forest Facebook pages. Recordings will also be available on the respective pages afterwards. KMUN News will continue to bring updates on fires during this 2025 fire season. A proposal to significantly increase signage at a large-scale McKinleyville business has split Humboldt County's Planning Commission, which also approved permits to expand a Petrolia area cannabis operation. Daniel Mintz reports.
Humboldt County's Planning Commission gridlocked on allowing more signage for a U-Haul facility at McKinleyville's former Mill Creek Shopping Center with deep division over accommodating business needs versus heeding the intent of a recently approved sign ordinance. There were only 4 of 7 commissioners at the September 4th meeting, and after a tie vote on approving the additional signs, the permit hearing was continued to the October 2nd meeting. Originally on the consent agenda of a meeting last month, a permit change to allow 22 more signs was bumped to field some public comment. Of 14 emails and 2 voicemails, 11 supported the change, 4 opposed it, and 1 was an information request. Bordered by School Road and Central Avenue, the sprawling U-Haul moving and storage facility consists of 2 buildings. The U-Haul facility's general manager said there's a need for directional and informational signage. Despite the fairly robust initial public response, there were no takers during the hearing's public comment period, but commissioners had a lot to say. Commissioner Thomas Mulder noted that the sign ordinance provides room for negotiation through the conditional use permit process.
So for me, I feel that we went through a long process with the ordinance adoption and left this option available for people to come forward, and I feel like they're going through the proper process. And personally, with the economy the way it is in Humboldt County, I have a hard time trying to say no to a business that's wanting to invest money. I mean, it's going to take labor, materials, and capital investment, which means that they're probably going to stay open for a little bit of time, which could provide more jobs. So I don't want to say no to business.
But Commissioner Jerome Kiriazzi described U-Haul's request as a bit excessive, and Commissioner Peggy O'Neill said a majority of social media posts opposed it, and what works for U-Haul in large city doesn't fit in Humboldt County.
I understand having signage that directs people from one place to another, but that's a little excessive, and I would have liked to have seen an attempt to modify the signs to provide the directions that they need to provide to the public and stay within the ordinance. And then if that wasn't possible, to come back and say, well, you know, this isn't just going to work. But instead, it's like, well, this is what we do everywhere else, so we want to do it in McKinleyville.
The disagreement frustrated Commission Chair Ivor Skavdal, who described the notion of rejecting the sign proposal as unfair and tersely responded to an interjection from O'Neill.
I'll express my frustration. This was on the consent calendar the first time it came to us. We pulled it off consent to give the community time to provide us input. We reached out, and staff did a great job, went out into the community. Not one person from the town of McKinleyville spoke in support or opposition tonight, even after all of that effort. And we're sitting up here telling the applicant that we're going to modify their signage plan. I don't think that's fair to them. And I understand. You got to say what you wanted to say. I get to say what I want to say. Please respect me on that.
Mulder's motion to approve the new signs yielded a 2-2 tie, with Kiriazzi and O'Neill voting against. The commission voted to continue the hearing to October 2nd, when an odd number of commissioners might be there. Also at the meeting, commissioners unanimously approved permits allowing a 10,000-square-foot Petrolia area cannabis farm to expand to almost 80,000 square feet of outdoor cultivation. About half of the expansion is being done under the county's Retirement Remediation and Relocation Program, which allows cultivation expansion in exchange for moving farming areas away from environmentally sensitive areas. Under the permits, the farm will include outdoor cultivation, non-volatile cannabis manufacturing, and a commercial nursery. Conditions were added to an original proposal to address water concerns. In Eureka for KMUD News, this is Daniel Mintz.
On September 5th, Save the Redwoods League, a nonprofit organization based out of San Francisco, and 49 other organizations sent a letter to Governor Gavin Newsom, Senate President pro tempore Mike McGuire, and Speaker Robert Rivas, urging action to appropriate funds from Proposition 4 to fund and reauthorize California's cap-and-trade program. This comes in light of the Garnet Fire creeping closer to McKinley Grove, an area identified by the Giant Sequoia Lands Coalition as one of the most vulnerable of the 80-plus sequoia groves in the world. Proposition 4 is a prop that authorizes the state to borrow money for climate projects, wildfire and forest programs, and drinking water improvements. California's cap-and-trade program is a policy that was launched in 2013 with an aim to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. KMUD News spoke with Ben Friedman, the Director of Government Affairs and Public Funding for the Save the Redwoods League, for more about the cap-and-trade program.
California cap-and-trade program is essentially a program that charges polluters for the pollution they emit, and the money that is raised from that program goes into what's called the Greenhouse Gas Reduction Fund, or the GGRF. And those funds can be invested in all sorts of different ways to fight the climate crisis here in California and around the country.
With the 2025 legislative session coming to a close September 12th, if funds aren't allocated from Proposition 4, then there will be a lack of investment for forest resilience and wildfire resilience, putting redwood groves like McKinley Grove at risk. Friedman explains further what needs to be done.
Well, Prop 4 needs to get done. That's right. By September 12th, this Friday, the California legislature and the governor's office, Governor Newsom's administration, they've got to get a lot of different things done before the legislative session is over. And in one of those to-dos, one of the things they've got to get done is allocate funds from Prop 4, Proposition 4, which was passed by voters back last November. And so they're, you know, the legislature and the governor, they're coming down to the wire, and the league and a huge community of voices across the state are really pushing to see significant allocations of money come from that Prop 4 fund and get spent so that we can continue to fight for the natural resource protections that are so important to all Californians. You know, there's so much money in Prop 4 for really important things, including wildfire and forest resilience. You know, talking about the Garnet Fire, there is $1.5 billion in Prop 4 funding that voters approved back in November for forest resilience and wildfire resilience. So what's at stake is if Prop 4 funding does not go out the door, we miss a huge opportunity, a critical opportunity, to fund the projects that make our forests more resilient to wildfire, more adapted to a warming and drier climate. The league does really serious restoration work alongside state and federal and tribal partners across the Sequoia Range to make sure that giant sequoia groves like McKinley don't get lost due to these climate-driven fires. 20% of giant sequoias have died due to climate-driven wildfires since 2015. And it's one in five. And this is, again, one of the, like, iconic symbols of California. And so we're, Save the Redwoods League and our partners, we care very deeply about passing Prop 4 because what's at stake is some, you know, those investments do exactly the type of forest restoration and stewardship work that make our forests adapt better to the climate world that we're living in.
With September 12th just around the corner, the league encourages people to call their representatives and state senators to get funds allocated before the end of the legislative session. After the end of the legislative session, the task of reallocating funds could be pushed back as far as May or June of 2026. Additionally, delaying Prop 4 appropriations could lead to an estimated 100 full-time employees in forest maintenance and resilience that would be laid off from working for California state parks due to lack of funding.
What people can do is they can lend their voice. They can call their legislators in Sacramento, their state assembly members and their state senators, and let them know that they want to see Prop 4 funds allocated and go out the door before the end of legislative session. And that's really something that folks can be doing Monday night, Tuesday morning. The legislature is all in Sacramento, you know, ironing out a lot of different details, but we don't want to see Prop 4 go by the wayside. You know, I know that, you know, K-Mud is on the Northern California, you know, sort of represents Northern California, and the state senator is the Senate pro tem, Senator McGuire. And so he has a lot of power to influence these end of session legislative goals. And he's been a great champion for Proposition 4. And we want to see him take a leadership role in getting Prop 4 done.
For more information, the website is savetheredwoods.org. In state news, California Assembly passes bill blocking ICE from getting private health data without warrant or court order. KPFA's Kennedy Coelho reports.
A state bill has passed in Sacramento blocking ICE from accessing private healthcare spaces and data without a warrant. Senate Bill 81, sponsored by East Bay State Senator Jesse Adeguin, affirms that healthcare is a human right. The measure was carried on the assembly floor by San Leandro Assembly Member Liz Ortega, who spoke in support. She called it necessary to protect the safety and privacy of all Californians.
SB 81 requires healthcare providers to create non-public areas in their facilities and bar immigration agents from entering unless they have a valid judicial warrant or court order in order to strengthen patient privacy and protections. Immigration enforcement has no business in our hospitals and our clinics.
This bill comes after the rise in immigration enforcement activity in the state that in just the last 2 months saw over 4,000 Californians arrested by masked armed agents in raids across Southern California, including in sensitive locations that were once off limits to ICE, like healthcare facilities, churches, and schools. As a result, many are no longer receiving the care they need, resulting in deaths, including two babies, according to Assemblymember Ortega. Healthcare professionals have described takeovers of hospitals by ICE agents, including at Stanford Hospital. On Tuesday, a protest called on Stanford officials to adopt clear policies that protect patients after Aleida Rodriguez was taken to the ER severely injured and unconscious following her detention while taking her daughter to school. Her primary doctor, Dr. Yusra Hussein, said she was repeatedly interrupted by a half dozen ICE agents who roamed the halls armed, asking staff for identification.
We as physicians and nurses and healthcare workers, whenever we walked in and out of the ward, we actually had to sign our names and show our badge to prove to them that we actually are legitimate. For me, I was asked 3 times, why am I there attending to my patient and what brings me here? And I said, I'm her primary care physician. It is actually a common courtesy for the primary care doctor to come and see their patients. And that didn't sit well with them.
The California Nurses Association, the largest union of registered nurses in the state, celebrated the bill's passage. Sandy Redding, CNA president, said healthcare providers have a legal and moral obligation to advocate for their patients. She noted that this is the first time in her 35-year career she has seen ICE agents in healthcare spaces, adding that she has even witnessed armed agents intimidating patients and hospital staff.
One of the hospitals that, I'm in the Dignity Health Corporation, and one of the hospitals, Glendale Memorial, they had ICE agents behind the registration desk with their assault weapons. And there was no process put in place. The nurses and healthcare workers that were coming into the hospital to go to work were scared. They didn't even know what that was. They were found roaming around the hospital in areas that were not public. And we just really demanded that we have some processes put in place.
SB 81 passed 88-18. It now heads to the governor's desk, who has until October 12th to take action. For KPFA News, I'm Kennedy Coelho.
In national news, wildfire air pollution a growing problem exacerbated by climate change, according to UN report. KPFA's Christina Onnestad reports.
Air pollution causes more than 4.5 million premature deaths every year. Scientists at the United Nations are highlighting the role wildfires have to play, saying climate change increases their severity and the smoke in the air that releases damaging microscopic particles, which then spread around the world. Lorenzo Labrador is scientific officer at the World Meteorological Organization.
Air quality respects no boundaries. That the wildfire season has the tendency to be stronger and longer every year as a result of climate change. So that is an issue, and that is part of the reason why we see those patterns regarding wildfires and degradation of air quality.
He says, for instance, wildfires have scorched the Amazon, Canada, and Siberian Peninsula, carrying smoke to neighboring countries. And smoke from the Iberian Peninsula has traveled to Western Europe in a matter of weeks.
The current wildfire season in the Iberian Peninsula has been one for the records. For instance, the Copernicus Atmospheric Monitoring Services has highlighted that this has been, in terms of cumulative emissions of CO2, the strongest season has happened since they started taking records back in 2003, so the strongest season in 20 years.
The recent fires in Spain and Portugal killed 8 people and forced some 35,000 to evacuate. The UN's findings come as new reports from World Weather Attribution, a consortium of academic scientists studying climate change and its impacts on weather events, say climate change exacerbated the wildfire's intensity by 30%. A weather event of that severity was common every 500 years. But since the climate has warmed 1.3 degrees Celsius, such intense wildfires are now forecast every 15. The World Meteorological Organization says cross-border hazards like wildfires need a global response. I'm Christina Onnested, reporting for Pacifica Radio, KPFA.
In national native news, Antonia Gonzalez reads today's headlines.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. In Alaska, there are a growing number of cases involving young teens in small remote indigenous communities who are sexually exploited online. As KMBA's Rhonda McBride tells us, the FBI believes one North Slope man who was indicted this summer could have other victims.
After FBI investigators arrested Robert Segovin and Wainwright this July for child exploitation, they wanted to be sure the North Slope man didn't have any other victims. In charging documents, they showed evidence of how Segovin, who is 31, used social media chats to badger teenage girls into sending him sexually explicit pictures of themselves. The victims were as young as 12, 13, and 15. Chloe Martin, a spokesperson for the FBI's Alaska field office, says, although this case takes place in one of the most isolated places in the nation, it is not beyond the FBI's reach.
No matter where a child lives, they deserve safety, support, and justice.
Martin says sexual exploitation occurs in large cities and small communities alike, and it helps to end the abuse when victims come forward.
Victims may be eligible for certain services, potentially restitution, and rights under federal and or state law. And of course, all identities of these victims will be kept confidential.
The FBI's Anchorage field office and the North Slope Borough's police department worked together on this case, which came to light last October after a North Slope Borough police officer took a complaint from a 15-year-old girl. She told the officer Segovin had asked for images of her breasts and private parts. In the course of the investigation, he learned that other children had received similar messages and that a 13-year-old had sent Segovin nude photos. The FBI is asking anyone who has information about Segovin's alleged crimes to contact the Anchorage FBI field office or go online at tips.fbi.gov. In Anchorage, I'm Rhonda McBride.
Hundreds of First Nations chiefs recently gathered in Winnipeg for their annual meeting. As Dan Karpinchuk reports, most of the talk was about the impact on their communities of new laws allowing the fast-tracking of major infrastructure projects.
The concerns brought to the Winnipeg meeting focused on how First Nations rights were being challenged by the push by Ottawa to have major projects moved forward. Many chiefs are angry that the new law, Bill C-5, was pushed through with only 7 days to review and comment on it. Cindy Woodhouse-Nepenak is the National Chief of the Assembly of First Nations.
The way the act was introduced has caused concern for many chiefs. This assembly is an opportunity for chiefs to deliberate and to provide direction moving forward.
But 2 days into the gathering, the chiefs voted down a pitch to include First Nations infrastructure ventures in the government's national plan to fast-track major projects like pipelines and mining of precious metals. The resolutions didn't get the needed 60% support. Some said passing the resolution would have been supporting the federal legislation and could have put their rights in jeopardy. The vice chief of the Federation of Sovereign Indigenous Nations said major project discussions must include Indigenous people because these decisions affect treaty rights by impacting their ability to exercise rights to hunt, fish, trap, and pass on their way of life. More than 600 chiefs from across the country attended the meeting. Other issues on the table included talks on child welfare reform, native policing, health care, the drug crisis, and the lack of proper housing on reserves. For National Native News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
That's all for tonight's broadcast. Thanks for listening. Thanks to our engineer, Javier Rodriguez, and thanks to our reporters, Daniel Mintz, Kennedy Cuello, Christina Honestead, and Antonia Gonzalez. KMA News is online, and you can find us on KMA.org and now streaming on most podcast platforms, including Apple Podcasts and Spotify, where you can download our stories and newscasts for offline listening during your rural commutes. You can also follow us on social media. If you have questions or suggestions, you can give us a call at 707-923-2605. Or send an email to news@kmud.org. Are you passionate about your community? Looking to report on what's happening around Mendocino? KMUD News is looking for streamer reporters in the Mendocino area to cover local Mendocino stories that matter. Whether you're a seasoned journalist or just eager to learn, we'll help you get started. You'll get training, support, and a chance to amplify real voices from your community. If you're interested, email news@kmud.org for more information. Redway Community Radio, Inc. is funded by Press Forward, the national movement to strengthen communities by reinvigorating local news. Learn more at pressforward.news. Reporting for KMUD, I'm Nat Cardos.